science enthusiasts. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker. They're the science dogs on social media. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take some deep dive into an area of science and look at the research that's going on with our pets. We'll also have an expert guest who will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Science Podcast this week. It's getting colder and Bunsen is getting more energy. Every degree Celsius that it gets below zero, I think Bunsen gets about 100% more energy outside. We talked about it in Pet Chat on Saturday, and this podcast comes out a little less than a week after our Saturday Pet Chat on Twitter. And he was at the dog park, and at the dog park, he was roaring around. He was faster than Beaker in some places. And as Beaker has gotten older, she's gotten faster and faster and faster. And Bunsen can't keep up to that anymore. So anyways, it was really cool to see that Bunsen has all of this energy and he always gets it when winter comes. He has unlimited energy to run through the snow and play. I think he's just a little bit more comfortable and he knows that winter is coming. On the Science Podcast, this week in science news, we're going to talk about a new type of glitter and an embarrassing story that I'm going to share about glitter. In Pet Chat, we're going to talk about some new evidence that is linking separation anxiety in humans to their pets. And our expert guest is Dr. Zazie Todd, who's an animal behavior scientist. She's the author of a couple books, and she's just an all-around amazing, knowledgeable person about training her pets. Hey, dogs, did you hear that Abraham Lincoln went to a craft shop and got a whole bunch of glitter? Yeah, that's right. He changed his name to Abra Glam Lincoln. Okay. All right. To be honest with you, I was having trouble with a pun this week. That's pretty good for glitter. All right, on with the show. There's no time like science time. Please don't unscribe for that pun. This week in science news, let's talk about an alternative to glitter. Now, before we get into the glitter science and why glitter is potentially a problem for the environment, I have to share my glitter story. I don't know if I've shared this before on the podcast, but it's one of my favorite short stories to share about glitter. This is about 10 years ago. Our staff has, at Christmas time, this staff party, and there's a raffle, and they get these things donated. It's a free raffle, so a couple teachers win some prizes. And this one year, I won a prize, and I never win anything. Literally, I never win anything. I don't try to win stuff. I know you need a ticket to win, but I feel like even if I had all of the tickets, I'd still wind up losing. But this is one of the only times I've ever won anything in my entire life. I won something at this Christmas raffle, and it was this giant poinsettia plant in this huge pot, it was potted and it was all like, it had like glittery wrapping paper around it. So I went up to the stage in front of all my peers, got this giant thing, hauled it back to my table. And everybody was like, this is too big, put it on the floor. So I moved it to the floor. And then, after the meal, some people were going out for quote unquote drinks. And that's not something that I do, but I go and just for camaraderie. So I went out for, I think I had like a Diet Coke and some appetizers. And then I went home. So I got home and Chris saw me and she's like, oh, hi. And then she's like, what's going on? And I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, where did you go? And I said, I didn't come home right away. We went out to a pub. Some people wanted to get, and after it's Christmas time and it's a Friday and people wanted to get a drink and I went out just to hang out with them. And they're like, are you sure you went to a pub? I'm like, yeah. She's like, I don't think you went to a pub. And I'm like, why? And she looked at my clothes and my shoulders and they were covered in glitter. And she's like, I think you went somewhere else. And I was like, oh my God, no, it's from the poinsettia. And she's like, what poinsettia? And I said, I won a poinsettia. She's like, where's the poinsettia? And I was like, oh God, I forgot it at the school. I didn't even have evidence that I won this giant poinsettia. I forgot it at the school because we were in a hall eating lunch. And then I moved it to my classroom and then I forgot to haul it home. So that was a very awkward exchange with my wife. No, I did not go somewhere sketchy where I may or may not have been covered by glitter. I actually got covered in glitter by a poinsettia. That is my embarrassing story. I hope you enjoy it. Now, on the science front, one of the things that glitter has a bit of a problem with is that the way glitter is traditionally made is it's made using microplastics. Bad, right? That shimmery glitter stuff that kids love to use. It's in glues. It's at craft stores. You know, you make Christmas ornaments or Christmas cards. You put the glue down and shake the glitter onto it. Big problem because microplastics aren't good. We really don't know how small they get before they completely go away and animals eat it. I'm not saying that animals are straight up eating handfuls of glitter. Glitter is just part of the plastic pollution problem. So a new non-toxic biodegradable alternative could possibly get rid of the problems with glitter. So people who love glitter can continue to use glitter on whatever, including poinsettias. This glitter comes from plants. This is from Nature Materials on November 11th. The plant is called Pollea condensata, and it produces iridescent blue fruits called marble berries. You can Google these if you want. They're actually pretty cool looking. Now, in the cellulose that's in the berry cell walls has a specific type of fiber that refracts and reflects wavelengths of light to create that hue. So the idea that the researchers had was that if the plant could make this naturally, why couldn't we harness what's going on in the plant that's made of cellulose and will biodegrade and turn into glitter? So they whipped up a bunch of this fibrous concoction and they poured it onto plastic to see what would happen. And over time, the fibers settled into these structures that looked like staircases, and they could tweak factors such as, and those staircases are what would refract the light, these specialized structures of fiber. Depending on how the bond occurred to make these different spiral staircases, the colors would change. So that allowed the researchers to tweak things here and then. And of course, they're keeping it pretty secret, but they could tweak how those bonds are formed. And that would turn this fibrous mixture from clear to shimmering ribbons of rainbows of color. Ah, and from that, the hope is to make glitter. Now, it's a ribbon. So how do you turn a ribbon into glitter? Well, you just chop it up into little tiny pieces. Now, one of the problems is it will biodegrade. It reacts with the sunlight. So that's one thing that plastic has going for it is it stores really nice. It keeps forever. But perhaps we need to think past forever to tomorrow. And I love this story about glitter. It allows me to tell my embarrassing story. And we have scientists all over the world working on the plastic pollution problem in the most unlikely places. And that includes a replacement for glitter. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, we're going to talk about separation anxiety in humans. So this caught my eye. I was trolling for things to talk about in Pet Science this week, and it's about separation anxiety between humans and their pets. And the reason why perhaps it caught my eye a bit is a lot of the guests that we interview on the podcast are younger, and they've just kind of started their career. They're PhD students. They finished their PhD. They're starting their own research. They're on the younger side. Not all of them. And I'm not saying that any of the older guests aren't amazing. You are. You're freaking amazing people. But a common thread that they have is they had pets when they were growing up. They moved away or they got really busy and they just couldn't justify having a pet or they missed their pet. And that's a common thread is that when they went home to visit their parents or their ancestral home or whatever, they always look forward to seeing their family pet. And that's what caught my eye. I saw this and it's a study about people going off to university and struggling because they are missing their pet. This study comes from Washington State University. And the quick conclusion is that 3/4 of the people surveyed had pet separation anxiety, with 1 in 4, 25% of those surveyed having moderate or severe symptoms. So the sample size comes from 150 first-year students who also had pets at home. All right, so that kind of it eliminates people who've never had pets. So you have a pet at home, it's obviously still alive, and you're a first-year student. So this is your first kick at the can of moving away from home. The vast majority of the respondents were women. And that's a limitation of the study that they talked about. They'd like to have more gender parity there. I mean, you get who you get sometimes with these studies, but at least they acknowledge that, which is great. And they surveyed the group before they arrived on campus and then after their first couple weeks on campus away from home. This also came right at the time when a lot of the classes were going online due to COVID. So there's a whole bunch of factors here, moving away from home, but also social isolation because of COVID restrictions. Now, the findings found that many people, 3/4, had separation anxiety from their pets, and 25% had moderate to severe symptoms, which included a whole host of problems, anxiety, trouble sleeping, sadness, depression. Like, these are pretty serious side effects. And it's something that the study wants to bring to universities at large to take heed of for students who are suffering from mental health issues. One of the biggest ways that you could combat this is having therapy dogs at your university to bridge the gap for people who are missing their pet. Petting a dog or a cat for as little as 10 minutes in other studies, and that was also cited by this one, reduced that, by, I guess, that stress response, that anxiety response. So that's also something they're pushing for. That we know this is a problem. People are coming to a university from home. It's stressful. They're away from their family, but they're also away from their pet. And for a lot of kids, quote-unquote young adults, kids, that are coming from homes, that may be a closer attachment than some other people in their family. They may have, sadly or not sadly, I think we can all agree that this is true for some people, they miss their pet more than they miss the members of their family. The study acknowledges that you just can't randomly give pets to these students. You have a lot of responsibilities as a student. You're not necessarily in the right place to give your pet that kind of time. So a bridge between, as they mentioned, was get some therapy dogs out there, bring some animals in for people to interact with. The evidence shows that it would definitely help. So if you have separation anxiety from your pet because you've moved away from them, don't feel bad. You are the majority. But if you can, try and find an organization that lets you interact with an animal. That's the cure for that separation anxiety if you can't get back home to your pet. That's Pet Science for this week. Hey everybody, thanks for listening to our show week after week. If you want to know how to support the Science Podcast, here are a couple ways. It's always going to be free to download, so you'll never have to worry about paying for it. But, you know, things do cost money running a podcast, and here are a couple ways you could help us out. One is join our Patreon page. It's amazing. It's growing. It's almost like an extended family. There's multiple tiers of support, and we have lots of fun perks for being part of our Patreon page. The other way you could support us is giving us an awesome review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, anywhere you can rate our podcast. Give us a great review. The third way you could support the show is checking out the BunsenBurnerBMD.com website. We have awesome merch there. We worked really hard finding quality merchandise that's comfortable with vibrant colors. And you'll find in limited quantities over the next couple months, maybe even less, the 2022 Bunsen and Beaker calendar. So 3 ways to support us: the Patreon page, 2, give us a great review, 3, head over to our merch shop and see if there's anything there you'd like. Thanks, everybody. Now on to the interview section. It's time for Ask an Expert on the Science Podcast, and I have Dr. Zazie Todd, an animal behavior expert and the author of a new book called WAG, The Science of Making Your Dog Happy. How are you doing today, Zazie?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to talk to you anytime on the podcast, where our guest is actually both trained in science and trained to study animals. It just gives me all the fuzzies because it hits it right home what we're all about here.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
My pleasure. Where are you calling into the podcast from? Where are you in the world?
I'm in Maple Ridge, BC, which is just outside of Vancouver. It's actually part of Metro Vancouver. But as you can tell from my accent, I grew up in England. So I'm originally from Leeds in the UK.
How long have you been, did you move to Canada when you were young? Was it part of your school or is this a recent thing?
It was about 13 years ago. Before that, I lived in Thailand for a little while, and then my husband and I always wanted to come to Vancouver. When I was a PhD student, I presented a paper at a conference at UBC, and my husband came too, and we both thought, wow, this is a wonderful place. We'd like to live here someday. So we're incredibly lucky that a long, long time later, his company was bought up by a Canadian company with an office in Vancouver, and all of a sudden it was possible.
That whole area of Canada is just magical, isn't it?
It is. It's really, really beautiful and amazing. I feel very lucky to live here.
Not that England isn't beautiful. My son plays in a marching band, and they went to England on tour, and there's some very cool vistas in England. You moved to a place that's just as rainy of maybe where you left, though, hey?
Yeah, so people say, how do you cope with the rain? And I'm like, well, you know, it rains in England too. So it's okay. And I don't mind the rain. I think I would really struggle with the cold temperatures that other parts of Canada get.
Yeah, like one province over where I live in Alberta.
Yeah, I would find that quite hard, I think, through the winters. The summers would be good, but the winter would be tough.
All right. So could we talk a little bit about, like, we've got some really exciting things to talk about, but kind of for framework, I always ask guests about what their education is. You have a doctorate. Could you chat with us about what your PhD is in?
Yeah. So my PhD is in psychology, and I'm always quick to say it's in human psychology. It wasn't in animal behavior. It was actually to do with the social psychology of how people use metaphor. And metaphor is not just a literary device that people use in poetry. It's also something that people use in everyday language all the time. And so I was interested in that. That's what I did my PhD on. But of course, through psychology, you always study some animal behavior. And over the years, I did sometimes have students of mine do bits of research on pets, even though most of the time my own work was on communication. And that's really nice because thinking about how to communicate about different issues is basically what I do now when I'm writing my blog or writing my book. I'm using all the things that I used to do, only putting it into practice.
So when you were a young person, was there something, I always like this actually, I ask every guest this and it's just as fascinating every time. What steered you into your path to in science initially? Like, were you interested in psychology when you were in high school? Middle school or like a teenager?
Well, I was quite interested in science as a teenager. I especially liked chemistry and physics at school. But this was a long, long time ago when girls were kind of discouraged from going into science. And some of my teachers would tell me that I shouldn't be concentrating on science. I should be sticking to the arts and humanities. Unfortunately, I didn't listen to them.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. They're they need to give their head a shake.
Yeah, hopefully people don't say that kind of thing anymore. But this was a while ago, and that's it. I think my experience of that time is not uncommon. And for the last 2 years of high school, you have to specialize in England. You have to pick three or four subjects that you're going to specialize in. And I wanted to do physics and chemistry. Several times my deputy head teacher actually came and got me out of class and told me that I should not be taking these subjects. I should be sticking to arts and humanities, but I didn't listen to him. So I discovered psychology at university, actually. I went to study medicine and hated it, and also was ill for almost the entire year of studying medicine. And we had classes in psychology, and I was really lucky because the guy who taught that class encouraged me to pursue psychology and helped me to transfer. And so I switched to psychology and did my undergrad in psychology and then my master's at Edinburgh in linguistics and then my PhD at the University of Nottingham. So undergrad was in Southampton and I'm from Leeds. So I moved all over the place, as people often do, in order to study where they want to study. Mm-hmm. And then after my PhD, I worked at the University of Leicester and Leeds in the UK working as a social psychologist. And then I came to Canada.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. So then I came to Canada and I thought this is a chance to do something different. And I had always wanted to do something to do with pets and animals. And so I did an MFA in creative writing and I started writing and I was fascinated. And this will go into, we'll talk about what I did next, I'm sure, in a moment.
I know. It's so fun and so exciting. I can't wait to get into it. Through your education of your training of your PhD and when you were working for I guess like in academia, right?
Yeah.
Do you have an interesting story you could tell us about that time?
Well, I used to have a lot of students doing different projects to do with people, mainly to do with social identity. And because I specialized in combining both qualitative and quantitative methods, so things to do with statistics and experiments, but also things to do with qualitative methods where you just talk to people and analyze how they talk about things. So I worked with a lot of people from different areas of psychology, including forensic psychology and clinical psychology, simply because I knew how to use the methods. So they had the expertise in the specific topic, but they needed someone who knew how to use the different methods they were using. So I had lots of students do some really interesting projects. But often when you're talking to people as a psychologist, sometimes things can come out that are a bit different than what you were expecting, because they know you're a psychologist and suddenly they'll start telling you something that wasn't on your question list. So you would sometimes have ethical issues to think about. And one time I actually had a wonderful, fantastic student who was a clinical psychologist, and she actually went into prison to work with prisoners in a high security prison to learn more about the treatment programs that they were undergoing. And so at the end of every day, she would ring me and tell me to do a debrief on what they've been talking about, because you never know what's going to come up. And as a psychologist, you have to be prepared ethically to deal with whatever happens to come up. So that was quite fascinating as well. I think I was lucky to get to work in a really wide range of different areas.
Each day would be brand new, right? Like there'd probably be very little repeats.
Yeah. And so for that student, each day she would speak to one or two different prisoners, including about the things that they had done, which obviously I can't share those specific things, but that would mean there were some really quite difficult stories in there, but also really quite interesting to learn about how the treatment was going and helping them to recover in case they were ever going to be able to rejoin society.
Yeah, that's a whole area of psychology that's, you know, if people are going to be rehabilitated, they need some help, obviously. And that's a whole area that most people don't think about.
Yeah, that's right. And that's probably not what you're expecting, because you're thinking I'm going to be talking about cats and dogs all the time. But
no, this is
what
great.
I did before I got interested. I mean, I always was interested in pets, but this was before I discovered canine and feline science. So when I was a PhD student, I could have done a PhD on animals, but it would have had to be on pigeons, because psychologists were only really interested in rats, mice and mazes and pigeons. You know, so not so much in companion animals. So I think it's really wonderful that science has finally discovered that cats and dogs are very interesting too.
Yeah. And especially like I talked on 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago on the podcast, one of the articles was I was talking about was cat research is lagging behind dog research. And there's like, it's important that we know more about cats, because in some ways cats are more similar to us than dogs. And we just, they're kind of a black box in areas. They just haven't been studied. But we might know way more about pigeons from classical psychology studies.
Yeah. And when you live with a cat or a dog, it seems crazy to think that people thought they weren't very interesting animals to look at. But of course they are. And I think it's really important for the welfare of cats and dogs too, especially for cats, because they often don't go to the vet as often as dogs do, for example. And that's partly just because it's so difficult to get a cat in a carrier. It kind of puts people off if they haven't trained their cat. And most people don't, but it really would help if more people train their cats to go in their carrier. And then it would be so much easier to take them to the vet.
Right. Yeah. My oldest son has got a cat and like trying to, it went into the carrier, but sure wasn't happy about it. So that's something we can work on in the future. So now you've moved to Canada, changing your, I guess, your whole career path into working with dogs and cats and companion animals. And you have an amazing newsletter and a blog all about it. I believe you mentioned that's when you started to write creatively.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah. I started my blog, Companion Animal Psychology, in 2012. And I always say to people that I think blogging is like dog years. You know, it's not really a normal year. It's like it's much longer because a lot of blogs don't stick around, and it's hard work to keep one going. But Companion Animal Psychology is where I blog about how we can use science to have happier pets. And so I have a new post every week, often about a piece of science, but a new research article, but also often just about more general things that we know about animal behavior and how to train dogs in particular. Also about training cats too, from time to time.
From time to time.
depending what comes up and what the new research is. And I started it really because I discovered that canine science was a thing and I was so fascinated by it and also by how relevant it is to everyday life with pets and how useful it is to people, because a lot of people grow up with dogs or cats and so they think they know all about them, but there are so many interesting discoveries and it's just really fun to be able to write about them. And so I have a free newsletter that people can sign up for if they want, and they'll get my free guide. I've got 7 Secrets to a Happy Dog and 7 Secrets to a Happy Cat, and they can go to my website if they want to get those. And then as well as the blog, this summer I started a premium newsletter called The Pawsitive Post, which is for people who want to know even more about animal behaviour. So again, that's sharing a lot of new science about cats and dogs and how it relates to people's lives, and also articles about issues in animal behaviour that I think will be interesting both to dog and cat guardians, but also to people who work with dogs and cats.
And you could send us those links to either sign up, or is the premium one like for, you have to pay for it, or are they all free?
Companion animal psychology is free, but the premium one is paid. And as well as the newsletter, it also includes a monthly webinar or some kind of online event or discussion. And we're going to be having a journal club as well, which is going to be really fun to get to chat about particular articles with people.
I would love to sign up for these. If you send me information, we'll make sure all of the links to get everybody signed up who's interested is in the show notes. So it's just there for everybody.
Perfect. Thank you.
How long has the blog been going for? You mentioned you moved to Canada. Was it about that time, 12 or 14 years ago?
I moved to Canada just a bit before I started the blog, and the blog's been going for almost, it'll be 10 years next year, which I think is quite a milestone to celebrate. So I did an MFA in creative writing at UBC when I first got to Canada, which was something I had always wanted to do. I'd always wanted to be able to write something about psychology that wasn't academic and that was aimed at normal people. So that was a really lovely opportunity for me to work on different types of writing and to improve my craft. So, and now what I'm doing, I feel like it brings together everything that I've done in the past, which is really lovely. So it uses the science and the psychology, and it uses what I know about the science of communication, and it uses what I now know about animal behavior and dog training and so on as well.
I love it. And on the heels of that, you have something like super exciting. You have a new book that I introduced in your introduction, which was, it's called WAG, The Science of Making Your Dog Happy. And it, I think it has a burner on the cover. Like, I was snooping about it.
It does.
It's got a Bernese Mountain Dog on the cover. I would love to know more about it. I'm sure our listeners would. Could you talk about your new book?
Sure. So thank you. I wrote WAG, The Science of Making Your Dog Happy, because I was inspired by my own dogs that I had then, Ghost and Bodger, and I wanted to learn more about how to make them happy and to share the things from canine science that are applicable to living with a dog, and especially to do with training methods, because there are still a lot of people who use outdated training methods instead of training dogs with positive reinforcement. And so WAG goes through all the different aspects of owning a dog, right through from getting a puppy or a rescue dog to training a dog, taking them to the vet, dogs and children, right through to senior dogs and those difficult times at the end of a dog's life, because that's a really tough time. I actually lost Ghost while I was writing the book. And so that's a tough time for everybody to go through and to make those decisions about when it's the right time, because everybody says to you, you'll know when it's the right time. But actually, if your dog has a long illness, it can be really hard to know when is the actual day to do it. So it goes through all of those different aspects of life. And every single chapter ends with a list of tips to apply the science at home. And then right at the end of the book, I've got a checklist for a happy dog, which is a list of the main things from the book, and people can use it to see what they're already doing right that they should keep on doing. And they can also use it to see if there are maybe some things that perhaps they could introduce or start doing with their dog to make their dog even happier than they are.
I'm tearing up a bit because of your emotional story, but also like it gives you just such a personal perspective on some of that writing.
Yeah, and so in the book, it is about the science, but I also share stories about Ghost and Bodger. And I've lost Bodger now as well, unfortunately. So I'm pleased that the rest of the world gets to learn something about them, which is very nice, because they were very special dogs to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's too bad they don't live as long as humans, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I know, definitely. And I've also been working on a book about cats called Purr, The Science of Making Your Cat Happy, which, you know, I wanted to make sure that cats aren't left out. So that will be coming out next year.
I have a couple follow-up questions. When you decided to start writing WAG, how long did it come easily? Did you have a vision in your head? Or was it like, did you hit writer's block as some writers do?
That's a really great question. And I have to say, no, it was really hard. It did not come easily. So for one thing, there's been a huge amount of research that I had to do. And of course, I was writing about a lot of the research on my blog already. So I knew a lot of it, but I had to go and speak to extra people. That was really fun. Lots of people were very kind in speaking to me. And I've got lots of excerpts from different kinds of scientists and behaviorists and so on in the book, and vets as well. But it's a long process writing a book. So in this case, I was lucky because I had an agent and she helped me with the proposal. In the proposal, so you have to put a list of what all the chapters will be and spell out what everything is going to be. But even so, I still found it quite difficult to write. But I think the hardest part was putting all of that together as to what would fit in. And then as for the editing was really tough because there came a point where I was 10,000 words over my word limit.
And oh my goodness.
I had to get rid of all those words. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. And it took me many, many times going through to decide. I had to make some really tough decisions about what to include and what not to include. But obviously the book's better for it because you don't want to write something too long. You want to try and get the length just right. And hopefully it's worked out okay. But it was hard. And it was a many years process for that book to come about. And I'm pleased to say that the next book, Purr, has happened a bit more quickly. But basically, a book is a long thing. And it's also a long time between a book, you finishing a book and a book coming out. So it's a big piece of work. And I think until you actually go into it, you don't realize quite what you're letting yourself in for. You know, it's just tough, but it's worth it. And then it's so exciting to be able to share with the world.
Yeah, you have this, it's almost, I would say every book that's written is a piece of art. And now this art lives forever on Earth. So that's pretty special.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that especially when I look at other people's books, because I love reading and it's just really nice to have something that's well-crafted and interesting to read. So yeah, it's a special thing to be able to publish a book and share it with people. I think I'm very lucky there.
Where can people find your book?
So it's in all good bookstores. And of course, it's on Amazon as well.
Okay, so if people check out Amazon, it'll be there. I'll put a link in the show notes as well to WAG.
Thank you.
So it's just a little click away. Obviously, shop local if you can, folks, right? We'll promote that. But I mean, if your local bookstore is 2 kilometers or 2 hours away, I guess check out Amazon.
Yeah, that's the thing. You see, I'm lucky. I live somewhere with a really great local independent bookstore. So that's very nice. And it's always good, I think, to support your local stores.
Last question about your book. Did you do book signing? Did you get asked to go to different places to promote the book?
I have done some book signings. I was lucky. I did a book signing in a pet store, which was great because then people could bring their dogs. But mostly, obviously, I've mostly been doing virtual things,
right,
and chatting
COVID,
to people,
yes,
about it because of the pandemic. But yeah, I think it was really special to do something in a bookstore and actually meet the dogs that the book was being bought for. That was lovely. That was so nice.
Oh, that's cool.
And who doesn't love meeting dogs as well? So, you know.
Oh, who doesn't love meeting dogs? It's the greatest thing ever. Oh, they're just so good. Mm. Now, without giving away, I know you don't want to give away everything in the book or much of in the book, but for just our listeners, could you give us some tips and tricks that are maybe in the book that you would be willing to share to keep your pet healthy or happy?
Sure. One of the things that I say to everyone is to train your dog with food. And I dare say a lot of your listeners are doing that already. But the reason I say it is because we know that a lot of people still use outdated methods, such as shock and prong collars, which unfortunately have risks for the dog's welfare. And that's the science behind that is one of the things that I talk about in WAG. So using aversive methods, unfortunately, it has risks of fear, anxiety, aggression, stress, a worse relationship with the owner. And also there's some research now that shows it makes the dogs more pessimistic. So it's really better to use food to train your dog because dogs are very food motivated, and it's an easy way to motivate them, and it works and it's effective. And there's even some research that shows that it works better than other methods, like better than a shock collar, for example. But another one that I think is really important is to give your dog opportunities to sniff. So I'm sure you know that dogs love sniffing and they like to go and they read the P-mail. And I like to use this idea of taking your dog on a sniffari.
And sniffari?
Yeah. So letting them follow their nose as much as they want, within reason, obviously, because some things might not be safe and they might want to go places they're not allowed. But giving them that opportunity to sniff, because sniffing is the most important sense for dogs. Like we go by sight, they go by smell. So it's really good for them. And there's some research that shows that letting dogs do nose work, which is like when they have to search for a particular scent, it actually makes dogs more optimistic than if they're doing another activity. In the study, it was heel work, but that was for rewards as well. So in both cases, they were earning rewards. But it seems that the act of using their nose made them more optimistic because it gives them autonomy as well as giving them the chance to use their nose.
Hmm. So like hide a treat somewhere in your backyard and they got to go find it. And that's their reward, like that kind of sniff work, like a sniffari like that?
Yeah. So nose work classes are actually something where the instructor will hide a treat. Usually to begin with, it's going to be in cardboard boxes and the dog will go into the arena to find it. And then you actually transition them to searching for a scent. So it's kind of like a pet dog version of actually being a scent detection dog.
Like a search and rescue dog kind of.
Yeah. So you can do everything simply from letting your dog enjoy the smells that are there or scattering treats in a safe bit of grass and letting them find those treats with their nose, which is really fun. Or you can have some cardboard boxes in a room in your home, shut the dog out of the room, put a treat in one or all of them and let the dog in to come and find them. And then if you just put it in one of them and they find it, add some more treats to kind of reward them for finding it. And it only takes a few goes of that and it actually can tire a dog out. And then you can go to classes. And I've only ever been to a beginner nose work class, but there are people who follow it through. It even goes right up to finding scent in like in a school or something like that. So you can get to really quite complex things, which the dog absolutely loves. So anything involving the nose is good for dogs.
Yeah, we're working on that with Beaker, and we train Bunsen with that, our Bernice. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it stresses him out, but I think he likes it. Like when on walks, because we live on a farm, right? Mm-hmm. When he gets distracted, I'll go and hide, mm-hmm. and then he'll find my scent. Like he'll track me down and find me, which is, I don't know if that's stressing him out or maybe I shouldn't do that, but he's always, he likes it. He knows mm-hmm. It happens and then we're back to normal again, so.
That's awesome. I bet he loves finding you.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, it's tougher in the winter, though. I wonder if there's something like it's harder to find the scent in the cold. Like if I jump behind a snowbank and cover myself up with snow, it's way tougher for him than in the summer if I like jump behind a tree or into the weeds or something like that.
Yeah, and I think the directions of the airflow and the wind make a difference. And maybe the bank of snow is actually blocking some of the scent from going. I don't know. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. But there are dogs that are trained to find unfortunate folks that got swept up in an avalanche or something like that. So it can be done. Bunsen's not there yet. He's beginner level, as you said, beginner nose work.
Well, I mean, the great thing is that there is everything through from beginner level to expert. And, you know, whatever is fun for your dog is, I think, usually fun for the owner too.
One more follow-up question before we move on. I am shocked, literally shocked, when people bring up there's other training methods besides like positive reinforcement. I just can't believe it. I'm like, are you serious? Like, you would do that to your pet, animal creature that you love so much. Did you get any pushback from trainers that use alternative methods? Like, is it because obviously your book is with the science and definitely debunking that method of training is not the greatest.
Yeah, so I think often when people use those methods, it's because they've been to a dog trainer who has told them that they should do, and they feel a bit icky about it, but because that's what they've been told to do, they often do it anyway. And then later when they find a trainer who says, actually, please don't do that, they feel kind of relieved because they didn't really want to. And the thing is, dog training isn't regulated, so anyone can call themselves a dog trainer. And I would like personally to see shock collars banned so that they can't be used, but they are legal, so people can use them here. And yeah, there is pushback because there are a lot of trainers, unfortunately, still who do use those methods. And yeah, sometimes my inbox is an interesting read.
Oh, I was wondering about, I'm sorry to hear that. I was just so, because like how you train dogs, if that's your life's work, it becomes your worldview, right? And you have this other opposing worldview, I'll cut this out, but I'm just imagining it's similar to, you know, somebody promoting vaccines and you've got somebody who's anti-vax, right?
You don't have to cut it out. I think if someone is used to using those kinds of methods, it must be very difficult to learn that actually they're potentially causing harm to dogs, because I think people love their dog. I think even those trainers who use their methods, they love dogs and they just don't realize what they're doing. And I think psychologically that has to be quite a difficult thing to come to terms with and a big change to make. And also it's also a technical change, and you have to start thinking about what you want the dog to do instead of how you stop them from doing something that you don't want to do. So you also have to change the way in which you're thinking about the dog as well. And I think for some people that's quite hard as well. That's because it's not what they used to.
It's proactive instead of reactive. Like, that's what I'm finding with a lot of the training techniques. Like, Bunsen and Beaker are trained through positive reinforcement, and it's always proactive. Like, hey, there's a dog coming towards you. You need to be proactive instead of like now the dogs are too close, instead of trying to reef the dog away or whatever, right? So,
yeah, exactly. And the thing is, I think once you get used to training with food, you're not going to go back. And isn't it nice when you see the look on the dog's face when they're expectant and hopeful and they know that they've just earned themselves a treat? It's just lovely. And I think for the people, it feels like you're building a better relationship with your dog that way too. So,
yeah. Oh, I love it. I love taking them. I love training the dog so much. It's so fun. I can't wait to read the book. Thank you for sharing information that's in the book and where people can grab it.
That's okay. Thank you.
Zazzy, can we move on to the next question? Have we hit everything in the first four there?
Yes, for sure.
Okay. The next question is one of our standard ones, and it's a pet story question. And we're right on the mark with you. We always ask our guests to share an interesting or unique or, you know, a touching pet story from their life. Do you have one you could share with us?
I would like to share a story about my dog Ghost, who passed a few years ago. He was a Siberian Husky Alaskan Malamute cross. So he was a rescue dog. We adopted him when he was already a few years old. And so I mentioned that I live in BC, and there's actually a lot of wildlife here, including black bears. And Ghost was very interested in all of the wildlife, and he actually turned out to be a very reliable indicator of if there was a bear in the area. So I learned to tell from his body language if there was a bear around. and he was very, very interested in bears. And he would have liked to chase them away if we gave him the chance, but we learned early on that he needed to be on leash if there was going to be a bear about. that's a different story. But one time I was going to take him for a walk, and it was in the evening, and my husband was out. My husband was actually at my neighbor's house, where he had spent the afternoon canning salmon in their yard. And I think the bear must have smelled that from a very long way away, because
yep.
In the afternoon I'd already seen a bear in my backyard and not worried about it. But then in the evening I went out with Ghost. We went out the back door and we turned around the corner of the house, and the bear was right there.
Oh my goodness.
And so I'm only a few steps from the back door, and I thought, that's okay, we'll just go straight back inside again. But Ghost would not move. He absolutely would not move, and he was very big. There was no way I could possibly drag him. So, and obviously I wasn't going to let go of the leash to get myself back inside, because then who knows what he would have done chasing the bear away. So I was stuck, and the bear's right there, and I couldn't get back in the house. And I said to the bear, I'm sorry, but there's nothing I can do about this. You're going to have to help me out. And I know you're supposed to yell, like, go away, bear, or something like that. But that's just what came out, because I'm English and apparently I'm even polite to bears. So the bear went up a tree, which was great, except Ghost still would not move. He was really interested in bears and he just would not move. So we were stuck out there for about 15 minutes, I think. And then my husband appeared at the end of the driveway with his arms full of all this canned salmon that he'd just been canning. And I said to him, there's a bear up the tree. And he looked up and he saw it. But, you know, he had to come down the driveway with all this salmon underneath the bear. And then finally, with him there as well, we were able to persuade Ghost to come back in the house. And we stayed in the house, and the bear went away.
Oh my goodness. I've seen videos like that before where people, like, we're not used to bears. We've had bears in our area very, very rarely out in Alberta. Mm. But where you live and where other people live, it's like, hey, there's a bear. Okay. You know, you got to be careful, but it's not anything new. Yeah. I love that you just like calmly talk to the bear. I've seen a video where this guy's trying to get to work and there's a bear and a bunch of cubs in his backyard. He's like, excuse me, bears, I got to get to work, bears. Can you leave, please? And he's just like, you know, talking gently to these bears to get them to go.
Yeah. Well, luckily they usually go away. Mm-hmm. I think if you see your mom with cubs, it's a bit different. And I'm not going to lie, it is scary to see one. But once you've seen them a few times and they go away, then, you know, that's a relief. And you're like, okay, it's a bear again.
It's another bear. Oh, yeah, and for people listening, it's dangerous to let dogs off leash around a bear, because the bears are much bigger than any dog ever will be. So
yeah, it's very dangerous. And many of the stories of people getting into trouble with bears and getting injured by bears, it's when their off-leash dog has gone and harassed the bear, and then the bear comes running, but the dog gets away, and you as the person are in the way. So you don't want to let your dog chase a bear away.
The dog goes to start trouble and realizes there's too much trouble, and it's like, well, I'm out of here. You're on your own.
Yeah.
Oof. Oh, well, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing that about Ghost. Now, as a I'm a fan of fantasy and science fiction. Is Ghost named after Jon Snow's direwolf?
Well, do you know, he came with that name, and So we don't actually know, but it really suited him. So possibly, because possibly. It was, yeah, it is possible that someone at the shelter had named him because of that, but we don't actually know. But the name suited him, so he kept it.
Ah, that's great. Well, thanks for sharing your pet story.
Thanks for listening. I'm always happy to share stories about dogs and cats.
I could literally, if guests could give me hours, I would just like to listen to their stories about their pets for hours, because they bring such joy to me too.
And I bet your guests could listen to Bunsen and Beaker stories all day as well.
yeah, that's funny. Some of them actually asked, and I'm like, well, I can tell you, but I'm going to have to cut it, because the podcast isn't about Bunsen and Beaker in this section. So thanks for sharing that. Then the next kind of standard question that we ask is a fun one. It's the super fact. It's our guests to share something that they know that kind of would blow people's minds. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I do. And I think it's possible that the fact itself won't blow your mind. But I think the thing that will blow your mind is that scientists have actually studied this. And it's an example of just how useful canine science is. So there's some research from the University of Lincoln, which found that dogs will run faster to get a piece of sausage rather than a piece of kibble. And they trained dogs to run along a runway, and the dog could tell by the bowl that was left at the end whether it was going to be a piece of sausage or a piece of kibble in there, and they ran faster for the sausage. So I think people would expect that dogs will run fast to get to food, but this is a really nice finding because it's so useful in everyday life. One of the most important things to teach dogs is a good recall, to come when called. And we're always, as dog trainers, we're always telling people to make sure that you use your best treats for recall, because it's an important behavior, and because there are lots of other competing motivators, like your dog might be sniffing a squirrel or something, you know, trying to find something interesting going on. Yes.
I think moose leg is the highest treat for Bunsen, and I can't outdo that.
No, that would be tough. So this is why we need to use our best treats for recall, which in my case is usually something involving tripe, because the dogs love it, even though I don't. But it could be cheese or roast beef or something like that. And I just think it's really great that scientists are actually looking at this kind of thing, because it's so useful and so practical for people to use. And again, if you think about the importance of the methods that we use, it's also great that they're not just looking at the kinds of methods, but how to use specific methods better too.
That's amazing. We were literally working on that last night with Beaker. We were working on recall with her in puppy school, right? Or obedience training, or whatever the right term for it is, I forget. And that's exactly what we were using as our best treats for Beaker recall. And turns out our best treats are little freeze-dried fishes. They're like these little super smelly fishes. She just goes bananas for them.
Yeah, minnows. They're very popular with dogs, I think. Yeah.
Minnows, yes, that's what they are. Yeah, some kind of minnow thing. Yep.
Yeah. Perfect.
That is a super fact. So dogs will have a little more jump in their step if the treat is something to their liking better.
Yes.
I think people are that way too. Like if there's food in the staff room and it's like, hey, we got bran muffins in the staff room, everybody's like, okay, well, maybe I'll get those at lunch. But if there's an announcement that's like, hey, some parents have brought in some, you know, butter tarts and Nanaimo bars, their teacher's stopping their lesson and running for that staff room.
I can imagine that. Yeah, definitely. For me, it would be something involving dark chocolate, I think. I would be or marzipan. Yeah, dark chocolate and marzipan. I would definitely run very fast to get that.
Yeah. Now, people always ask who are not from Canada about butter tarts. Moving to Canada, did you sample some of the Canadian sweets like butter tarts and Nanaimo bars?
Yeah, so I'm not very keen on very sweet things. So those are a bit too sweet for me.
Butter tarts are like, yeah, it's like hurt your teeth sweet. Yes, you're absolutely right.
But I do like maple cookies, and I do like anything with maple syrup in. So, yeah. I like the salmon. The other thing that's special from here is the wild salmon is just amazing.
Oh, it's so good.
That's quite special too.
Oof. Yeah, and you have to be on the West Coast. Like you just can't, like Alberta's salmon, it's like how many days old would it be? Weeks? Like it's just not the same.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're lucky here that and English salmon is more often farmed. So it's not the same either. I have to say the West Coast salmon is definitely the best.
Well, we better get off food because it's a long ways out from my supper. So, but thank you for sharing the super fact. Our very last section is one of my favorites because we get to ask guests about something that they love that's important to them outside of their area of work. Could be a hobby or a cause. And you wanted to talk about gardening. Do you do that as like a stress relief or part of expression of creativity?
It is partly stress relief, and it is partly not disappearing behind a giant hedge of brambles, to be completely honest. Because we're lucky, we've got 2 acres, most of which is treed, but It's absolutely beautiful in this part of BC, and I just love spending the time outside, and especially in summer, I love to watch the hummingbirds. Again, you see, that's something that you don't get in England, and it's just really nice to be outside enjoying the fresh air and growing a few nice flowers. And I don't really grow veg as much because it can be a bit of an issue with the bear, and also we have a bit of a short growing season exactly where I am, so I mainly go for flowers and try and keep the brambles at bay. I don't want to make it sound like I have a beautiful parkland. It's always hard work, but I don't mind because it's just nice getting involved doing things outside. And sometimes I'm really, really lucky and I get to see some of the wildlife go through. Like, I've seen the bobcat a few times.
Oh, cool.
That's incredible. I have seen a cougar a few times. I'm not going to describe that as incredible, though.
They're terrifying.
A bit scary.
No, but anybody listening, you do not mess with the cougar. Cougars are crazy dangerous.
Yeah, definitely. But it's just nice being outside and spending time in the fresh air. And the air here is very fresh as well. Having lived in various different places where the air is not fresh, you really come to appreciate good, clean air too. And it's nice. There are parts of the year when you don't want to be outside because it rains such a lot. but through the summer, it's just lovely here.
Yeah, drier and hot, right?
Yes, yes. Nice temperatures, except not this year. It was too hot this year.
Oh,
but
man,
normally
tell me
it's
about
nice.
It. Yeah, there was parts of BC that just baked this year, just like Alberta, but more in BC for sure. Mm. So when you're talking about brambles, are you talking about blackberry brambles? Or
Yes, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So the joke we always make in Alberta is like, if you want a little tin of blackberries, like a little tiny plastic container or like, you know, a little sack of blackberries, it's like $100. Mm-hmm. And in British Columbia, in the lower mainland or like all over British Columbia, the island, they're a weed almost. Like, you have to be careful. They'll eat your whole house or your garden or cars.
Yeah, they will. It's amazing how fast they go. I swear, sometimes they grow like an inch in a day. It's just incredible. If you cut them back, they just keep on trying to grow more. So, like, we have some blackberries because we like to harvest them and have blackberry and apple crumble or crisp, as you call it, and so on. But you have to also keep them at bay. And probably this means I need to get goats. I keep trying to argue this with my husband, but he's not so sure. But they would keep the brambles at bay.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's the one. When we go through, we try to make a trip into BC once a year. And half of it is just like what grows in British Columbia during the summer versus like Alberta. Right. Mm. And the blackberries are just like such a treat. They're everywhere. You can tell who's not from British Columbia when they're like randomly picking back blackberries all the time and, in dangerous locations. Like, why are you on the side of the highway? Well, I saw blackberries and we thought it was the only place. No, they're everywhere. So
yeah, they're everywhere. And before that, the salmon berries, they're not so good for us to eat, but we can eat them too. We mainly leave those for the bears. But also there's a type of ground blackberry here, which is really nice. So not just the regular blackberry thing, but also the ground blackberries. And they're really, really tasty.
Yeah, I think I would garden more if I could grow some of the stuff that grew in BC. well, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, all hobbies help with stress relief. And man, there's nothing is better for your soul than being out in nature, I feel. And I think there's probably evidence to back that up.
Yes, there is. Absolutely, definitely.
We're at the end of the interview, Dr. Todd. Thank you so much for talking with us today. I learned a lot from your conversation, and there's some amazing resources that we'll be sharing in the show notes to this episode, and links to your book. So just from me to you, thank you for giving up your time to chat with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been really fun to chat with you.
And before we go, can people follow you on social media?
They can. So they can find me on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. And if they go to my blog, companionanimalpsychology.com, they can find all the details there and they can follow by email too.
Perfect. Again, we'll have all of that's going to be in the show notes, folks. You literally have so much resources at your fingertips now.
Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, it's time for story time with me, Adam. If you don't know what story time is when we talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks. Mom, do you have a story?
I sure do. Although it's been a fairly uneventful week, we've just been hanging out and hanging out and hanging out every day. Bunsen came into the room yesterday while I was teaching, and he laid on the floor and started talking like, wah, wah, wah. And I just made a video of him and Beaker being cute in with me learning about linear equations. And I think they thought I was barking up the wrong tree because they didn't really want to learn about tail wags per minute. And that's my story.
My story is going to be about Beaker. So Beaker, if you don't know, she's like a ninja. She'll follow you places and you won't know. Like you'll go into a room and then you'll look behind you and then Beaker, just right there. She's very quiet. Okay, so one time, the gate to the downstairs was open, and we thought, okay, Mom must be down there. And then we were looking for Beaker for a little bit, just because we wanted to, you know, say hi to the little Gomer. Guess where she was? She was downstairs. She was in the open gate, and we couldn't hear her down there. So she must have snuck down the stairs and stayed down there for who knows how long.
What does she do down there?
I don't know. She just walks around. And looks at things. And then she tries to find some things to steal because she likes stealing things from downstairs and then bringing it back upstairs.
She's like Mr. Steely. That's 7 grapples.
Oh, a stapler. That's 4.5 grapples.
Sock.
Oh, 6.5 grapples. Anyways, so I took Beaker and Bunsen down there afterwards because Bunsen just decided to come with. And then they started fighting. And because Bunsen has a lot of fur on his paws, he just slips on the floor upstairs because it's tile. But downstairs, there is no slipping because it's carpet. So Bunsen and Beaker can just fight at light speed. And Bunsen can hold his ground because he's not slipping everywhere trying to evade Beaker's attacks. Anyways, this is my story. Dad, do you have a story?
So every week, Beaker has been going to agility training, which has been really fun. We were a little worried about her focus the first day because we got there and she wanted to bark at this dog that was beside us. I don't know what this dog did to her. Maybe she knew it from a past life. I don't know. But she maybe had to poop too. That's what we think. So after that, after the barking and then she went out to poop, her focus was better, but we were still a little like, oh, you know, that was like 10 minutes of her not being the best student in the world. But this week, she was a rock star. She did so good at agility training. She went through the tunnel and she went over the jumps and she walked on the board and we were really, really proud of her and it was super fun. And she had fun too, I think. She was a little unsure about the tunnel, but she worked up her courage and she zoomed through the tunnel and it was super cute. It's hard to videotape agility training because you need a lot of focus as the handler with the dog. So I was just more focused on having fun with Beaker and getting her to learn stuff than taping. So we might try and get some footage later on. But that's my story. Good job, Beaks.
That's the end of my section. That's the end of story time. Can't wait to see you guys on the next podcast episode. Bye-bye.
That's the end of another podcast episode. Thanks for coming back week after week to listen to our show. Special thanks to Dr. Zazie Todd, who talked to us about all of the ways you can make your dog more happy. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our top tier patrons on Patreon. Without their support, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. Take it away, Chris.
Chris Kelly, Samantha Dodd, Kimberly Bond, Nate Stephenson, Debbie Anderson, Courtney Proven, Renee Hardy, Mary Rater, Shelby Leggett, Mary Coos, Katya Lynch, Marianne McNally, Andrea Persons, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Bianca Hyde, Sandy Brimer, Tracy Halberg, Jenny Jaguar, Lila Periello, Lynn Armstrong, Lisa Schwartz, Catherine Jordan, Donna Craig, Lila Ashir, Jody Ogren, Liz Button, Kathy Zerker, and Ben Rathert.
For science, empathy, and cuteness.